You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell, and this is The Wheelhouse. My guest today is as tough as they come. He's a former Special Forces soldier who grew up in a strictly regimented orphanage and now lives in a remote spot in northwest Scotland. But Tom McLean is by no means a recluse. In fact, over the years, he has become one of the United Kingdom's most celebrated adventurers and motivational speakers. Among his many achievements, he was the first person to row solo across the Atlantic, a feat he accomplished in 1969. In 1982, he set another world record, sailing across the Atlantic in the smallest boat ever to make the crossing. 3 weeks later, someone beat his record in a vessel 8 inches shorter. McLean's famous response was to take a chainsaw to his own boat, cutting 2 feet off the end of it before crossing the Atlantic again to reclaim the record. 5 years and numerous adventures later, McLean rode the Atlantic yet again, regaining his title and setting a new record for the fastest time. 30 years later, that record, 54 days, is unbeaten. He has also crossed the Atlantic in a boat shaped like a bottle. And now he plans to do it again, aged 74, in a vessel shaped like a giant sperm whale. Yes, you heard me correctly, a giant sperm whale, which he built himself from 3/4-inch steel plate. It is 65 feet or 20 metres long and 25 feet or 8 metres high, and it can squirt water into the air. Tom McLean is a true eccentric, a skilled craftsman, an accomplished sailor, and a proper hard man. Connecting with Tom at his Highland Outdoor Centre on the shore of Loch Nevis, a place only accessible on foot, was tricky. Especially so since we needed to get decent enough sound quality to record and replay our conversation. But we managed it. After a number of false starts, on the hoof, as it were, Tom was in a hut in the wilderness and I was in an echoey hallway here in Mallorca. The results are perfectly clear, but a little odd, so I thought I'd explain. I began by asking Tom about his childhood.
I think it's that background that sort of toughened me up for the military and the adventures, really. That was a good start. It's a positive way of looking at it.
Well, absolutely, yeah, sure, of course. And you must do that always, I suppose. But did you have sort of a troubled early life then in the orphanage, or was it pretty good?
No, you know, I mean, I had to do as I told. My number was 81, and it was quite a bit of a regime, but I didn't know anything else. I went in there when I was 3. So it was pretty tough. You had to fight your corner. But then I came out and joined the paras, and the paras was easy after the orphanage.
Really? Okay. So after the parachute regiment, while you were in the parachute regiment, I should say, you joined the SAS.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, okay. And I don't know how much you're allowed to talk about these things, but where did you end up with the SAS?
Well, not too much. I'm not to talk about it too much. But in the paras, I was in Borneo, Rathfan, Borneo. Did quite a bit in the paras and four-man patrols and, yeah, quite exciting. Enjoyed all that. And then I actually rode the ocean. My first row was in the regiment, we call it, at Hereford. Ridgway and Blythe, the two guys in the paras, Captain Ridgway was my officer, Che Blythe was my sergeant in the anti-tank platoon. They rode before me, and that inspired me, and I thought, yeah, I'll have a go at that. And I was coming out of the regiment, and I thought, I'll ask the CO, and he said, yeah, get on, we'll do it, keep your mouth shut.
So that's what inspired you to row the Atlantic when you were, what, 26 or so years old? The fact that Che Blythe had done it ahead of you?
That's right. It was my sergeant in the platoon. It inspired me, and you know, I used to read Shackleton and Scott and all the adventures, and I didn't have a family as such, and I thought, yeah, I'm going to just go and do my adventure. I'll build a boat and ship it to St. John's and come across.
Well, you say come across as though it's easy, but how long were you at sea?
Oh, well, it was pretty tough. I was at sea for 2.5 months. I never heard a voice. I never had a radio. I had an emergency radio, but that was only a beacon. So I never spoke to anybody for 2.5 months, never heard anyone. I was just on my own, three pairs of oars, a whole load of food, and no cover or anything, and using sextant and logs and time for navigation.
I was going to say, no GPS back then.
None at all, no. I don't mind, I'm just bobbing along, heading east, and I never got a sun sight for the first 10 days, so I really didn't know exactly where you are. But you don't need to know exactly where you are, just the general direction. So you draw a line from A to B, and you want to be somewhere around that. But I found that I was about 150 miles south. And so then you just adjust, and then instead of going just east, you might put a bit of north in it. And then about another week after that, I got another sight. And they're not accurate sights. They're, you know, you're bobbing around, you're taking 3 or 4 sights and averaging it out. But no, you're not to get too excited. Just bob along. I'm doing it because I want to do it. This is my thing.
So back in the day when you were rowing the Atlantic, without the aid of GPS to constantly correct your course, you had to take sightings in order to correct your course. So presumably, you know, you took a pretty sort of fairly, you know, not, it wasn't a straight line route, shall we say?
No, it's all over the place. I mean, you'd have a gale for 3 or 4 days from maybe the northwest, and you'd be driving your southeast. And if it was a gale, you wouldn't be rowing anyhow. You'd just be drifting along with a rope hanging out, a big loop, just to keep your stern into it. But if it was very bad, you'd put your sea anchor out and turn to, hove to, as you say. But yeah, you'd allow that into your next calculation, and then you'd be zigzagging over the line. And then towards the end, I think it all went wrong a bit. I got driven south again, and then had to work my way back up again for the last few weeks. But I roughly knew where I was. And then, so when I first saw land, I thought I knew where I was.
You did that when you were about 26 years old. And since that amazing voyage, you've opened an outdoor adventure centre basically in the middle of nowhere in northern Scotland. How did all that start?
Yeah, well, it's in the middle of nowhere. No, it really started that I left the regiment and I thought, well, I really want to go to the hills and do my own thing. So I headed up, and in fact, I didn't have a cabin, I had a tent. So I was in a tent for a year, and then I was in a bit of a shed for a couple of years, and then I started having army units, adventurous training, and then it grew from there, built a house, built a lodge. And we've been at it about 45 years now.
And when you say we, you're not on your own, are you? Because you've started a family.
Exactly. I was on my own at the beginning for about 8 years. And now I met Jill from Yorkshire. And we've got 2 boys, James and Ryan, both grown up, 35, 36, and getting on with it.
And Jill's presumably quite intrepid as well.
No. I think she would say she likes the family life and likes a bit of comfort. But those early days, or in fact 6 years she had up there, when we got married, she was in a shed for 6 months and carrying water from the burn, washing in the burn and making do. So she's hardy, but she'd like her comforts, I think.
Fair enough. So you rode the Atlantic, you set up an outdoor pursuits and adventure and training centre in the middle of nowhere in Scotland. That wasn't enough for you. In 1982, you sailed the Atlantic in what? Something about the size of a bathtub, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it's very, very small. But up till then, the smallest sailing boat to cross the Atlantic was 10 feet. An American called Jerry Spears, and he had a boat called Yankee Girl, 10 feet. So I built my boat 9'9" and shipped it out to St. John's, Newfoundland, and then came across quite well. We landed right into Falmouth there, and that was the smallest. But within a month, an American came in behind me, another one, maybe about 9'1", I think it was, and so I took a chainsaw and cut 2 feet off the boat.
Right. I was going to ask you, is that an apocryphal story, the story of you chopping 2 feet off the end of your tiny boat?
Oh, no. The BBC came along, set up the cameras and everything. It was on, you know, national news. I took out the chainsaw and, you know, I marked it. I knew where I was cutting it. It was, next to a bulkhead, and then once the bit's off, I can put another transom on. You know, it was all figured out.
Yeah, so you didn't render it unseaworthy by chopping the end up?
No. It was seaworthy. I took it back to St. John's and did it all again.
Tell me about the Taifu Atlantic Challenger. Now, first of all, describe the vessel.
Well, the idea, I mean, it's an idea. People say, oh, well, you've rowed and you've sailed and, you know, and I think somewhere along the line, I said, well, you can really go in anything if, as long as you've got weight below waterline. It's a strong shaped boat, but as long as you've got a lot of weight, it'll move along. And he said, well, a bottle. Well, I said, bottle, very good. It's three times as long as it's wide. Lay it flat, put in a taxi engine, building all the tanks in the bottom, so it's got a lot of weight down below, and ship in a four-poster bed and take it to New York and bring it back. And that's what we did.
How big was the bottle? And what was the bottle made of?
The bottle was made of steel, so you roll a cylinder and then roll another cylinder and weld them together and then, fit it out, put the floor in, put the tanks in, put the engine in. It had the heads, had a shower. It carried about 1,400 gallons of diesel. It had a taxi engine in it, and it was lined out in oak panelling.
And a four-poster bed.
And the four-poster bed, which was a nautical bed. It had, oak panelling all the way around it with heavy draped curtains. So, I mean, it was a six-inch oak corners on it. So, I mean, you're talking about a very heavy bed.
And in this giant steel bottle with the four-poster bed inside, did you cross the Atlantic on your own, or did Jill go with you?
No, I was... it would have been nice for Jill, but now I was on my own again. Took it to New York and had a few parties there, making sure everything was right. It was meant to be sort of a beer bottle, but it ended up as a tea bottle. So Taifu Tea, that's who it was.
Yeah, they sponsored you. So what year was that?
That was, bottle was 1990.
Right.
So that was the year of the bottle.
Okay, so we're getting, we're heading towards the present day. Because in 1996, or at somewhere between 1990 and 1996, you cooked up, you're a well-known British, can I say eccentric without sounding rude?
Yeah, you can say that. Some people call me mad, but I quite like that as well, because I think, I'm doing things. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, reasonable. So at some point over that 6 years, you cooked up, I think, what a lot of people would regard as your craziest scheme to date. But it has worked, but let's describe it. It is a giant mechanical sperm whale, and you've built it yourself. Tell us about Moby.
Yeah, the idea of Moby, I mean, again, talking to my friend Rod, you built the bottle boat and we've been, across the Atlantic and I've been to Europe in it, and, you reckon you can go in any shape? I says, well, yeah, pretty well any shape. He says, well, what other shapes? I says, well, maybe a whale. I mean, environment-friendly issues are on the go at the moment, but maybe I'll build a whale. My nickname was Moby Dick, so why not a whale?
She's pretty large. Well, she's large for a self-built vessel. So 65 feet long, that's around 20 metres in length. Can you describe her and her construction to us? For a start, how long did it take you?
It took me 2.5 years to build it with one engineer. A friend of mine had a fabricating yard. I won't go to a boat builder's, I will go to a fabricating yard. A good engineer, and a couple of welders, and we would cut out the metal, dog it in, and they'd weld up behind us. But it's a metal boat. It's not clear, it's not cardboard. In other words, the plate's not butted up and welded. It's unusual, because wooden boats can be clinker, but this is a clinker metal boat. So they're overlapped, and they're welded in, and they're welded out. It's mega thick. 14 mil roll plate down below. So it's a very strong construction. But when you first see it, you see a sort of a foam whale. It looks more toy-like, but under that skin, it's very strong. So it's 65 feet long, 62 tons, clinker-built metal, and has two Gardner 6LWs in it.
At 65 feet long, and this is key, because of the shape of a sperm whale, yep, this thing protrudes above the waterline considerably, doesn't it? And it's all enclosed. So how tall is this vessel?
Yeah, well, we're about 20 feet from the bottom of the keel to the top of its head, 25 feet at the top of its tail. But you have to remember that on the waterline, below, it's all about weight below waterline. It's a bit like ferries. They're huge. They're up there, but they stay up. So it's about getting lots of weight, like 4,500 gallons of fuel. You know, I mean, we can take a lot of fuel, a lot of weight, a lot of concrete below waterline. But to have the weight below waterline, first of all, it has to be built strongly. So we've got a strong boat with a lot of weight below waterline. But yes, it's exactly the same size of a large bull sperm whale. So 65 feet, it's got the same measurements and bulk.
What sort of accommodations do you have inside?
Well, much like most trawlers, you could say, fishing boats. I mean, we have four. Well, topside, we have one large lounge area with the navigation, steering, and then we have a blowhole through the roof. And then we go down below and we have heads forward and then a main cabin with four bunks. And then I have a captain's cabin with two bunks. And then I have a new heads, which we're going to make into a proper bathroom. Like the bottle boat. The bottle boat had a four-poster bed for a bit of fun and style. Well, the Moby is going to have a proper bathroom rather than a heads and a pump and a bit of cast iron bath, ball and claw feet and gold taps, that type of thing. And then we go down into the engine room where there's two gardeners, two header tanks and all the pumping station for all the tanks. And then you go through the engine room up in aft into the galley, quite a large galley, a big headroom, and then on up into the brig, which is up in its tail.
The brig. Do you have a deck? Can you get outside, get the wind in your hair?
Yeah, so when you're up on topside, up in the lounge, you can just walk through a door, normal door, 6 feet high. It's metal plated and it goes out onto the deck. So the deck is probably about 12 feet wide and about 12 feet long. And that, you know, the skin, the shape of it. If you imagine the whole thing being whole, just imagine taking out a bit of a circle on the top of it. And that down there is the deck. And it's got scuppers, big scuppers there to let any water out.
And, you know, obviously you've got a great sense of humour, four-poster bed, cast iron bath, all that sort of thing. But you also have, and ridiculous though this sounds, you can also pump water at high pressure out through the whale's blowhole.
Yep, the idea is that it's like 20 times the amount of air as water. So you set the air going off the compressor and then just open the valve and feed a bit of water in, and there she blows. So the idea is to a bit of realistic as we come into a harbour, a bit of fun.
And I lost track when you were telling me about the cabins earlier on, but I think you were telling me about four double berths. But there's accommodation for how many people?
Six. No, they're double bunks. There's two bunks, six bunks.
Right, okay. You've already circumnavigated Britain. Is she an easy vessel to control?
Not at the moment, because, I mean, as you, if you could see it, there's no actual windows as such. I mean, there's a whole load of portholes above the waterline. We've got a bit of a window up the front. So you can't see out very well. Well, if you did, it wouldn't look like a whale. So we're going to make a flying bridge, which comes up through a hatch at the top, and we'll have all the controls there. Well, at the moment, the gardeners are manual. In other words, someone has to stand there, shove it in gear, put on the revs. So we've got a lot of work to do in refitting that, in connecting all this with electric servers up to the flying bridge. That's the main, one of the main jobs. But once we've got that, we also already have a bow thruster, but I think we're sticking a stern thruster as well, because it's got a very large tail extremity. So if I spin it around, I can perhaps knock one or two masts down.
Yeah, got to be careful of that.
Yeah.
Now, when you circumnavigated Britain, presumably you didn't just chug around Britain without putting into shore at any point. You must have gone into anchorages and marinas.
I went to 50 harbours all the way around UK, a lot of large ones. Started up by Loch Ness into Inverness, and then all the way around Scotland, all down the eastern side, into London at St. Catherine's under the bridge. And so then we bunkered up for the winter and then did a sound tour on the south coast back to London and then all the way back to Land's End, all the way up to Scotland again on the west coast.
What sort of reaction do you get?
Very, very good. I mean, certainly families and kids just think it's wacky, you know, and good fun. Coast Guards get reports of when you're way on the horizon, when there's a bit of a sea, it disappears and comes up. It's very realistic at about 5 miles. So it's, you know, we get lots of fun out of it.
Apologies if this sounds like a stupid question, but when you're sailing around, you know, it's pretty windy in the North Sea and in the Channel, and certainly very windy off the Scilly Isles. And this thing, you know, you're although it's not heavy above the waterline, you're very prominent above the waterline, and you're not catching the wind and pitching and rolling.
Yeah, well, I did a little experiment. I mean, the main thing is you've got the weight below, which it's a trawler, but then you are above the water. It's the big bubble where it's sealed in. And so I thought I'd do an experiment off Exeter. It had blown a good day. And we brought a broadside on, turned off the engines and see what would happen. Well, the wind on the stem of the tail, it's quite a large stem because the wind going through the tail is not holding anything. It's the stem of the tail. Well, that acts as a mizzen. That pushes the boat round and the heads are up. And it seemed to work really well, you know, and it's, don't know, but it seemed to move forward. So good, strong boat, good in a sea, and no problem.
Right, well, we maybe want to have a word with the organisers of the Vendée Globe. How many knots do you get out of it? What sort of speeds?
Well, the gardeners both go in, rev up, and then bring it back a bit. She'll do about 9.5 knots. Quite good, steady. But then we would run it now, bring her back a bit more and bring her back to about 7, let her cruise up there. And then occasionally you knock one engine off and then run the others.
Right. So what is the plan at 7 knots?
And the plan is from maybe up here, which is Scotland, down to Glasgow. And then I like the idea of calling a few places like Dublin, where I'm from. And then maybe Liverpool and, you know, all the way down Bristol, and then maybe bunker up at Falmouth. And then once we've got all sorted, we're head for the Azores, where there's lots of whales, about 1,200 miles. Mess around there for a while, go amongst the pods and turn off the engines and blow away and make some noises and see what happens. And then we head off to New York. It was about another 2,300.
And you say we. It's not just you and the whale. Are you taking Jill with you this time, or the boys?
No, Jill still doesn't want to go. There could be a crew of about 6.
Right.
So there'd be a crew, that's 3 watches of 2, and myself as a floating around.
Right, right. And when do you plan to set off?
Well, I would say it would probably be next year. This year we hope to refit. We need sponsors, companies to get involved. Web address is info@tommaclean2c.co.uk, and anyone wants to get involved with the project, either company or private, or we'd be glad to hear.
So how much money do you need to raise?
Well, you need about 50, 60 grand to refit it. There's a lot of work to be done and make sure on things. And then there's more. So we need to raise 150, 200 anyhow. But we hope to raise some more money for maybe save the well, save this, or clean up the planet, clean beaches. So we need other charities involved. So we need a big, large sponsor, a charity, and the public as well to get involved.
Tom, that's fantastic. Thank you so much.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive, and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.